This is an ABC podcast.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Great to have you along this afternoon at 12:05 and on the Country Hour today, and shortly, in fact, talking about how you feel about fracking here in Western Australia. As you heard on the Country Hour yesterday, the Premier Mark McGowan saying that he's got a report in. He got that a couple of months ago, which he sort of initiated because up until this point, there's sort of a moratorium and bans in place on fracking here in Western Australia, but the government's set to make its position clear on the future for fracking before Christmas time. So today, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association saying it's all for fracking. We'll also hear from WA Farmers, Tony York from WA Farmers. But keen to know your thoughts too. How do you feel about it? What if it was happening on your property? Would you give it the green light? Let me know this afternoon. 0448 922 604. Also, having a talk about Australia's largest cattle company, and it's saying today that its decision to close its abattoir in the Northern Territory and focus on producing beef has been a really good move. We'll talk about those latest figures from AA Co's books. And animal rights group PETA has released new footage showing what it calls cruelty to sheep. PETA is targeting the lack of pain relief that's being used for practices such as castration and mulesing, which is that removal of the skin from the rear of the sheep to prevent fly strike. Now, this latest video shows shearing operations in New South Wales and Victoria, including some violent animal handling practices. And here's just a little bit from that video for you.
In 2018, an eyewitness worked for a sheep shearing contractor in Australia, the world's top wool exporter, and found that workers struck the gentle, frightened sheep in the face with sharp metal clippers and in the stomach over and over again with their bent knee. Shearers paid by volume worked at breakneck speed and severely cut up the sheep. Workers roughly stitched them up on the filthy shearing floor, giving them no pain relief whatsoever. Shearers even cut off huge swathes of flesh. This farmer put a tight ring around a sheep's scrotum, which is extremely painful, without anaesthetics, so that his testicles would shrivel up and fall off weeks later. When other animals' testicles didn't fall off as expected, shearers simply cut them off with their clippers. Again, no pain relief was given at all.
PETA, that is the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, is calling for consumers to boycott wool. And we have contacted a number of sheep and veterinary bodies for comment, including Australian Wool Innovation. You can see that video. It's on PETA's website if you would like to see it. It's graphic, but if you would like to check it out, you can do that on their own website. Later this hour, you will hear from PETA and Wool Producers Australia. And keen to hear from you too. Are these practices defendable today? How many of you are using pain relief? How common is that here in Western Australia, especially when that mulesing is taking place? How do we compare to what's going on in other states around Australia? How effective it is and the benefits of mulesing, and maybe the work that's going into trying to find an alternative to those practices. Does more need to be done in that area? Let me know this afternoon, and you can do that via the text.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
It would be great to get you involved in the conversation this afternoon here on the Country Hour, 12:09. Western Australia's newest zircon mine could break ground as early as next year. That's according to Diatreme Resources, which this week returned a positive definitive feasibility study for its cyclone project. This is based in the Eucla Basin. Zircon is used as a whitening agent for ceramics and pottery, but there are also a number of new age technological uses also being looked at for zircon. This remote project, would employ about 100 people during the construction phase and then 50 during the operation of its 15-year mine life. The CEO is Neil McIntyre, and he says it will now begin the financing process and hope to attract a joint venture partner so the company can also be involved in the processing of the mineral.
Well, it gives us a strong indication and signal to develop the mine in essence. So it improves the economics. The underpinning economics of the project are very sound, and its definitive feasibility is done to a much higher level than the previous studies have been done, indicating that the project is a go, essentially, full steam ahead.
So what happens next?
Really, over the next quarter, over the next 2 or 3 months, on the back of the release of this, we'll be putting together our commercial development partners. So those parties who will take equity in the project, form a joint venture with us potentially, and also look at the offtake or who will purchase the product from us. And then those parties will be assembled, and then I suppose the final go button will be pushed.
So you talk about that final go button. What sort of timeline are we talking here, Neil?
We'll be looking to assemble the major commercial parties who will come in with us over the next 3 months, and it would be very shortly after that that we would announce, certainly within the first half of next year. And then we'd be looking at starting construction during the course of probably third, fourth quarter next year. So really we're at the sharp end of the process in terms of, getting a new mine up and going.
So when you look at what you've got to do between then and now, what is there to do?
Really assemble the partners. We're in a fortunate position, even as a relatively junior company, but we've got all the major permitting, all of what's called the primary approvals are all in place. So all our mining leases in place, our agreement with traditional owners, the environmental approvals, the miscellaneous licences to establish the camp infrastructure, the road and the airstrip, that's all in place. So really we're talking now about assembling the financial partners to fund the project. So that process by nature is a lot shorter than some of the other processes. So we're really at the sharp end.
Yeah, and you mentioned some of your Chinese partners there. I mean, is that where you're looking to lean financially?
I think that's highly likely, given that the product, we're exporting a heavy mineral, looking at exporting a heavy mineral concentrate, and really the market appetite and demand for that is in Asian markets, in China in particular. So we see a logical extension of that to bring in the Chinese partner to help develop the mine. What we're looking at in an ideal circumstance is bringing in a party who may look to joint venture the end processing with us in China and buy into the mine on this side. So really it's about us getting participation on the Chinese side and then getting participation on the Australian side.
It must be nice to get to this point, Neil. It certainly hasn't been a short process.
No, it's taken us a while, and I suppose that's the lament of small companies, I suppose, developing projects of this size. It does get a bit stop and start, but we've toiled away, and we're now confident we're at the tail end of the process.
Diatreme Resources CEO Neil McIntyre with Tara DeLandgraft. 14 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Where do you sit on the fracking debate? Now, this is when you drill into rock and using a high-pressure mixture to fracture that rock so that the oil and the gas can escape, can be released. So some big money to be made there, because this method could open up what I'm told is trillion cubic metres of natural gas just here in Western Australia. But there are environmental concerns with this process, and that's why the state government has put in place a temporary ban on fracking and a few moratoriums in place too. The government is set to make its position clear on fracking just before Christmas. Tony Seabrook from the farm lobby group, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association, he's already made up his mind on all this, and he's all for fracking here in Western Australia. This is part of his conversation he had on ABC Breakfast this morning.
It's a wonderful way forward. It'll give us energy security at a time when electricity prices in Australia are the highest in the world. It's absolutely imperative that the emotion be taken out of this debate and we get down to the reality of the science. And the science says there's nothing wrong with fracking. It's been going on all over the world for 30 years and in West Australia as well. And this is just an emotive argument that will deny Australians the prosperity that we deserve. There has to be an amicable arrangement between the actual the people drilling the hole, the people that are going to extract the gas, and the property owner. Our past president has had fracking going on in his property now for 30 years. His experience has been nothing but good. This is not an invasive process. The actual area taken up by the fracking, the drilling of the single hole that then sends drill holes out in a number of different directions, is not invasive. The arrangements that can be come to between the landowner and the person doing the drilling can often result in better fencing, better roads, an enormous amount of infrastructure on property. Once again, look, emotion is the wrong way to judge this. And we've seen the catastrophe that happened up in Broome when a small group of lefty people, the basket weavers, the ones that deny progress, actually forced the offshore processing of gas to a floating platform off the coast. No benefit to anybody in Western Australia. We could have had that on land. We could have bought millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of investment and a huge number of jobs. And the people that stand up and do this, they'll ban anything. They'll ban glyphosate, they'll ban live export, they'll ban anything without knowing anything about it.
Tony, there are a lot of vocal critics of fracking, particularly celebrity musicians types, Jimmy Barnes, John Butler, Missy Higgins, to name a few. Are they the people you're referring to as basket weavers here?
Look, they are of the left. There's no shadow of doubt about that.
What would you say to them, Tony?
I would say to them, study the science. The science states that the fracking, if done correctly, triple-cased piping with concrete, plugged at the end of the day with concrete to the bottom of the hole, is a very safe procedure. And look, the emotiveness, which is all of this. You know, I just wonder sometimes, you know, people drive around the place in electric cars and they feel as though, gee, I'm doing a fantastic thing, without recognising that somewhere fossil fuel is being burnt to provide the electricity that goes into the car. So they insulate themselves from the reality of the world. And Australia needs access to these resources.
Tony, your opponents would say when you're talking about an abundance of resources, in your case talking about an abundance of gas, they would point to an abundance of sunshine and that we should be pursuing renewable energy instead.
Well, that's fine. We haven't got the batteries to operate during the night time. Renewable energy only works when the sun's out or when the wind's blowing. But the people that we're talking about here, their motives are pure. You know, they really believe in what they believe in. But I live on a bit of freehold land southeast of York. I produce enough food on that property to feed 6,000 people and clothe them and provide them with cooking oil, barley for beer, whatever you like. I'm absolutely certain today that if that country was not cleared and not as productive as it is now, they wouldn't let me clear it. And you can't have everything. You can't have a wonderful, pristine world with nothing happening in it. You actually have to accept the fact that progress is about progress, control it, work the way forward, that's beneficial to all parties, but not stop it.
Tony Seabrook, he's the president of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association on the Country Hour on ABC WA, 18 past 12. Tony York is the president of the other farm lobby group here in Western Australia, WA Farmers. Tony, have you made up your mind? The WA Farmers have a clear position on fracking here in Western Australia?
Yeah, thanks, Belinda. How are you going? Look, I think we're just a little bit more circumspect. I think we'd want to make some distinctions between the coal seam fracking, which is a lot of what's going on in Eastern Australia, as against the deep rock fracking that happens to a large extent here in Western Australia. The other thing is I think we want to be make distinction between the right leasehold pastoral holders and freehold title, and the WA farmers have always argued that as we have a right of veto in the Mining Act, we probably would like to see something similar in the gas field. So harmonising that right of veto to freehold title, that would certainly empower a lot of farmers and allow them to have a final say. I mean, farmers, they've always got the conflict of making sure they can preserve their water entitlements and their water rights as such, and they don't want to jeopardise those in the long term.
So if it came down to that, looking at the gas or the water supply on that property, which side would you sway?
Well, I think you've got to allow the farmers themselves to make that choice and give them the right to it. But, I mean, gas is an extractive industry. It's going to come and go, whereas water, you're assuming it's going to be a lot much more sustainable and will support an ongoing agricultural sector. So you've really got to guarantee absolutely that there's no risk to the water reserves. I mean, there are a lot of parts of Western Australia where there is no underground water, so there's plenty of areas where that's not going to be an issue.
You can be part of the conversation too on the text this afternoon, 0448 922 604. This through from Salty Matt, and I think referring to Tony Seabrook. He's saying, come on, Tony, electricity is way cheaper in Western Australia than in other places in the world. For example, New Zealand. You might know farming, but you certainly don't know much about the electricity sector or gas exploration. I'm all for fracking, by the way. But people need to stick to the facts in pursuit of their agendas to maintain credibility. Thanks for that, Salty Matt. 0448 922 604. And Tony, while we have you on the Country Hour this afternoon,
yeah,
and just mentioning earlier in the hour, talking about this latest video from Peter, not having a go at the shearing industry, but really targeting sheep producers not using pain relief when it comes to mulesing, the practice of mulesing, for example, and also having a look at some of the behaviour by some shearers, looking at slapping and punching livestock, for example. Have you had a chance to see this latest video?
Yes. No, look, I did just have a look at it just then, Belinda. Certainly, I don't think any of us can condone inappropriate behaviour, and we'd argue that those involved in the sheep industry in the main are very conscious of what they're doing, and a lot of us just want to stamp out that sort of behaviour in the shearing shed and won't tolerate it. On the terms of pain relief, look, there's a lot of pain relief is used across Australia already, so it's, you know, the footage was showing one farm wasn't using the pain relief, so that's unfortunate. We need to continue to encourage the use of that pain relief.
So when we look across Australia, where does Western Australia sit in terms of the percentage of farmers currently using pain relief for the practice of mulesing, for example, compared to other states?
Yes, so my understanding is this WA is a little bit behind. I think it's about 80% across the whole of Australia. And WA, something like between 50 and 60% are using pain relief in the mulesing operation. So certainly we need to encourage more of our West Australians to, you know, adopt the practice.
What's the reason for that, Tony? Why is there such a difference between the pain relief practices here in WA compared to other states?
Look, I don't know. There's local issues, different people and different customs in different areas and different contractors have a preference. But we've been using it ourselves for, well, maybe nearly 8 to 10 years, a long time, and we're certainly very comfortable with the benefits that we get out of using the pain relief. Better recovery, faster growth rates, higher survival rates. So all round, it's very worthwhile doing.
And would that be typical of the farmers using pain relief? Would they have been using it sort of the same amount of time as you over the last 8 to 10 years or so?
Look, I can't speak for everybody, but certainly I think a lot of people around me in the central wheatbelt have using pain relief for a long time, yes.
Now, what would you think? I know it's probably difficult to say, but for someone who's not in the farming sector, how would they see this latest video from Peter?
Well, look, you've got to be pragmatic about it. I don't think anybody operating effectively is going to be imposing any undue harm. So we're being practical and we're performing operations, not for the hell of it. We're doing it, and people need to realise this. We're doing it for very good reasons, to long-term protect the outcome of the animals over their lives. So you just need to be realistic and accept the fact, and we will continue to try and find ways and support ways of absolutely minimising any pain that's imposed.
This through on the text, it says, I'm a sheep producer in Carnamar, Perenjori. It would be interesting to know if any sheep breeders are not using pain relief for mulesing. We can still justify the practice for the prevention of fly strike, but not without the pain relief, says Keith. Thank you for that, Keith. And that picks up on your point you mentioned earlier, Tony, that the fact that WA is a little down on the rest of of the country as far as palm oil goes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't think that I'm sure the oil industry are aware of that, and I'll be working on it. I had a discussion during the LAMEX that revealed this to me, and I was very surprised to hear that Western Australia was a bit behind the rest of Australia. So we can fix that, definitely, just by encouraging more widespread use of it.
Good to have you on the country this afternoon, Tony. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
WA Farmers President Tony York on the Country Hour, 25 past 12. Good afternoon, Belinda. I'm not a basket weaver. Instead, a fourth-generation farmer. Fracking should be totally banned forever across WA. Thank you for that text, and you can keep them coming through. Quite a few to get through, so hopefully get to those shortly here on the Country Hour. News headlines, a look at the weather around Western Australia, not too far away for you. Australia's largest cattle company says its decision to close its abattoir in the Northern Territory and really focus on producing beef has been a really good move. The Australian Agricultural Company today released its half-year financial results. Lydia Burton has been looking through the figures. Lydia, what have the last 6 months been like for AACo's books?
Well, Belinda, if you take a look at some of the financial results, some of the big ticket items are, you know, the revenue, it's up 11% for the half year. So it's around $219 million. Quite a big figure, some would say. But then if you look at the overall net loss after tax, it's actually a loss of $68 million. Now, this is largely from the AACo deciding to revalue their herd. So we're talking about, you know, a figure that only happens on their books. It's not as if they've lost this amount. And they've revalued their herd from $628 million to $514, so down $113 million. But again, that's just a book figure for AACo, and they say that they've revalued their herd because of, you know, drought conditions, the livestock market more generally, cattle prices have dropped, and so this has all contributed to that decision. But if we look at the increase in profit, AACo said there's a couple of reasons for that. One is they decided to mothball the abattoir in the Northern Territory, which was running at a loss of about $60 million a year. So that money's gone back into the company. But the other thing that's contributed to an increase in revenue has been an increase in the value of their Wagyu herd. And it really is the Wagyus that continue to be their star performer.
So why has the Wagyu story been so successful?
Well, AACo says it's due to their premium luxury Wagyu beef brands, Westholme and Wallara. There's big demand overseas for these two luxury brands. In fact, there's been 34% more of this beef go to Singapore. Taiwan has increased its consumption 12%. And there's also demand from Dubai. So it's really because these overseas markets are looking at this luxury Wagyu beef brand and saying that they want it.
What about the drought, Lydia? What impact has it had on AACo?
Well, as I mentioned, they had to revalue their livestock herd. So on a book figure, it's had an impact there. They also have considerable stations in the Northern Territory's Barkly region and then over in Queensland, Western Queensland, which have been badly affected by drought. So there's been $28.5 million of extra funds that have had to be spent on stations to buy in feed and supplements. So that's had an impact. But also because Australia and the United States of America are in drought, there has been so much more beef onto the market. So AACo says it has put pressure on them as a, you know, branded beef, you know, as a company selling branded beef.
Lydia, thank you for going through those figures for us this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Belinda.
Lydia Burton, who is the presenter of the Northern Territory Country Hour, just going through those figures of Australia's largest cattle company, AACo, and saying today that its decision to close its abattoir in the Northern Territory and just hone in on producing beef has been a very good move for the company. ABC WA, this is The Country Hour. It's 29 past 12. And Sandra Shimane-Burke in the studio. What's making headlines, Sandra?
Hello, Belle. Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton says today's terrorism arrests in Melbourne reinforce the need for a crackdown on encrypted messaging services. A 21-year-old Greenvale man, a 30-year-old Dallas man and a 26-year-old man from Campbellfield are expected to face court this afternoon, accused of plotting an ISIS-inspired terrorist attack. The men were allegedly communicating through secret messaging applications. Police and armed forces have blocked streets around PNG's parliament and appear to have barricaded the building. Vehicles are being turned around in the street and media attempting to film have been threatened by police and army officers. There are about 10 police and army vehicles outside parliament and about 5 are visible in front of the building. And in cricket, Australian 2020 captain Aaron Finch says the sport needs to move on now that the bans won't be lifted for Steve Smith, David Warner and Cameron Bancroft. The Cricket Australia board has decided the trio will serve the full length of the bans that were given for their roles in the ball tampering scandal in South Africa in March. Bell.
Sandra, thank you for the update. It is 12:30 and Sandra Shimane-Burke back at 1 with a full bulletin for you. Still to come here on the Country Hour, we're going to take you off to the markets just before the news at 1. It's off to Mouche again today and looking at the prices and the yarding for the sheep sale today. John Testrow will talk you through that very shortly. Right now, let's head off to the Weather Bureau and with the details this afternoon, Mark Paul with you. Mark, let's have a look at northern and eastern parts.
Yeah, good day, Belinda. Not a lot happening up in the north at the moment, just a little bit of shower and thunderstorm activity up through the Kimberley and the northeast interior. Tomorrow that will contract to be really confined to the Kimberley by itself, and those showers and thunderstorms up in the Kimberley will persist for the next few days. The remainder of the northern half, pretty much fine. We're going to see maybe a little bit of shower activity about the coastal Gascoyne as we go into Friday, but that should have cleared up by Saturday, but rainfall figures would be very, very light. And really eastern parts through the southern goldfields, Eucla, we could see a little bit of shower and thunderstorm activity developing on Thursday, and that'll persist into Friday. Should be cleared out or contracted just to some coastal showers on the Eucla by Saturday.
And can you talk through the conditions in the southwest land division for us, Mark?
Yeah, we've got a ridge of high pressure at the moment that's producing some onshore flow about southern coastal parts. So we're expecting some isolated showers about south coastal districts. That'll persist into tomorrow as well. Rainfall figures are only going to be very light, though, so there's not going to be a huge amount coming out of that. As we go into Thursday, we see a trough starting to develop down the inland parts of the state, if you like. That could produce some showers and thunderstorms through more or less anywhere away from the central west district, so the Great Southern, the Lower West, the Central West, Southwest and the South Coastal District. Could see some showers and thunderstorm activity develop on Thursday. That'll contract to southern districts by Friday. So Great Southern, Southwest, Southeast and South Coastal Districts should have that shower and thunderstorm activity. And then by Saturday, just some South Coastal showers in the onshore flow. Also, as we go into Friday and Saturday, we could see just a little bit of shower activity about western coastal parts of the Central West and Lower West, but not a huge amount of rainfall in those. With the thunderstorm activity, we could see somewhere up to about 4 to 5 millimetres falling through inland parts and south coastal parts with that activity on the Thursday and the Friday.
Any warnings this afternoon?
Yeah, warnings for WA. We're looking at a fire weather warning for the East Pilbara, the West Pilbara and the Gascoyne coastal fire weather districts. And there is a strong warning. It extends from the Norwest Cape pretty much around to the South Australian border.
Thank you for the wrap. Appreciate that. ABC WA 27 to 1. On the rainfall figures in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, the highest rainfall total for the state was 3 mils in Denbarker, King River, Many Peaks and Mount Howick, all having 3 and all in the Great Southern. Off to the market shortly, a wrap of the yarding and the prices at the Mouche Sheep Market for you. Looking at succession planning, I wonder if that's an issue in your family right now. Maybe a little bit of help on the way for you if you're right in the middle of that conversation. That's just before the news at 1 o'clock today. On the text, a few conversations going on, some about mulesing, hopefully get to some of those shortly, and also fracking, two of the key subjects we've been discussing here on the Country Hour this afternoon. This through The Barnett government, after their fracking inquiry, nominated to accept 11 of 12 recommendations. They would not accept the recommendation to grant landowners the right of veto over access by oil and gas companies. We all know why. A resounding no by all who care about water, environment and communities. Rod at Irwin, who says, I live closer to a slick water, hydraulically fracked well than anyone else in Western Australia. And Ron says, we need pain relief to listen to the Country Hour. 0448 922 604 25 to 1. Well, pastoralists in northern Western Australia are concerned for the future of their export markets. This is after a preliminary vote passed through Israel's parliament to end the live export trade. The Israel cattle market, it isn't a really big one for Australian producers. And if you look back over the last 12 months to October this year, it was Australia's fourth largest export market, so making up just under 5% of Australia's total cattle exports. But for producers in the Pilbara, it's been relatively important because of its blue tongue virus rules. Now, Israel is one of nine countries which only accepts cattle exports from blue tongue free zones, and the Pilbara just happens to be one of those zones. This vote is just the first stage, and there are many steps in this process to implement a live export ban in Israel. But Chair of the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association, David Stoat, says losing any market would hurt Australian exporters.
My understanding is that someone in the Israeli parliament has started a process of getting legislation in place. So it's no legislation's been passed at this point. It's just the first stage of the process, which is still very worrying, but hopefully it won't go further than that.
Do you know what exactly the legislation entails?
It seems that it would entail phasing out of importing live cattle from Australia. I'm not sure about other places into Israel. So it's not clear how, you know, what sort of time period that'll be over, or whether other exporting countries would be affected. But certainly it is a concern for the Australian livestock industry.
Do you know how significant the Israel market is for Australia?
It's obviously a much smaller market than Indonesia or Vietnam, but it is important for some of the, particularly the cattle out of the Pilbara, where which can be less favoured in markets like Indonesia. So, you know, the numbers aren't huge, but it is an important outlet for some of the Pilbara cattle and sometimes Kimberley cattle.
If this goes ahead, if this goes through and the live export trade from Israel is stopped, what impact do you think that might have on Australia and WA in particular?
Well, it's just one less marketing option for Western Australian producers. So, I mean, we obviously want as many marketing options as we possibly can, and you know, it has to contribute to a lower price overall. So, it's certainly a worrying development.
Any idea from your perspective the likelihood of this getting through?
No, not really. I mean, you hear plenty of conflicting reports, depending on who you talk to. So you would think they would have bigger issues to contemplate in Israel and this sort of thing, but it's, you know, it's very difficult to know.
What would you like to see done from an Australian government or industry perspective to try and ensure this doesn't happen?
Well, it's a matter of the Australian government and ministers making representations on behalf of industry, which I believe Minister Littleproud has been to Israel and has done that. So hopefully those representations will help the industry keep this market open.
Live export has been a topic of conversation and has received quite a lot of negative press, as we're all aware, the last few months in particular. Do you think this move is a sign of the times and we might see more countries take similar action?
Hard to know. I mean, a number of countries, you know, Australian livestock are an important part of their food security. So it's difficult to think that other important countries would make such a move. I can't imagine that other countries would go down this sort of line.
David Stoat, he's the chairman of the Kimberley Pilbara Cattlemen's Association, speaking to Michelle Stanley. In a statement, the Federal Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, said Australia's diplomats continue to make representations to Israel to keep the live trade open. 20 to 1 here on the Country Hour. A few of more of your thoughts on the text. This through from Greg. We mulesed 1,800 lambs using pain relief and will continue to, despite the cost, have done for 4 years now and can see the benefits of the practice. And I'd urge other wool producers not using it to do so. The long-term viability of our industry, I believe, depends on it. Thank you for that, Greg. This from Tom in Benue. I need some pain relief. Bleeding from the ear holes. Peter and the anti-fracking crowd, give us a break. Thanks, Tom. And all the protesters are so misinformed about fracking here in Western Australia. All fracking in WA is for tight and shale gas and not coal seam, which is the type that presents the possible issues to the water table. The Department of Water has proved several times that tight and shale fracking in WA poses no threat to the water aquifers, and they would be the first to say no to it if there was any threat whatsoever. 0448 922 604 to have your say. Well, in a major step for Australia's niche bush foods industry, a group of Aboriginal organisations have got together and they've formed the Northern Australia Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Alliance. Now, at the moment, the alliance has 9 members and they're spread across the north from the Kimberley coast, just near Broome, to Manangreta in Arnhem Land. And the idea is by working together, this alliance can provide a more reliable supply of plums to the growing list of customers who really want to buy this native fruit. Jacob Habner is from the Indigenous Land Corporation and he's been one of the people to help create this alliance. And he spoke to Matt Brann about the project.
The Northern Australian Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Alliance, or NACPA as we call it, is an alliance of 9 Aboriginal-owned companies that harvest and process Kakadu plum and to sell into the Australian markets. And NACPA was established really to try and provide a bit of coordination and organisation to the supply side of the Kakadu plum value chain and make it easier for potential markets and buyers in the functional food and cosmetic industry to access reliable and scalable supply of Kakadu plum and extracts.
The 9 organisations involved in this alliance, they stretch from Manangreta in the top end to the far Kimberley coast. Tell us about the process of getting all these different groups together.
Well, it's been an interesting process. Really, us at the ILC, we've been working, I suppose, at a small scale with most of these Aboriginal businesses individually for a number of years now. And in 2016, a market demand study was actually commissioned to go and ask the market what they need in terms of Kakadu plum. And one of the key pieces of information they came back to us with is that they saw the supply chain as being very fragmented and difficult to navigate. And so over the last 12 months or so, the ILC has been supporting many of these community businesses to, I suppose, start to coordinate and work together. And earlier this year, 2 or 3 of those communities really, really said now is the time to establish an alliance and start to work together. And I think in August, all 9 of the alliance members met in Broome to scope out and set out a vision for how they can work together. And not only to service their own needs in terms of sharing knowledge and information, but also in terms of really delivering the market what it needs. And really the big picture here is that, you know, we're trying to grow the Kakadu plum market from what we think is about 20 tonnes a year nationally, you know, up towards the 60, 70 or even 100 tonnes nationally over the next decade. And this alliance is really going to form the bedrock of really providing stability in that supply chain.
These 9 organisations, how many tonnes could they harvest?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And each of the communities have different capabilities, obviously. Some are starting out Some, such as Wadair Community or May Harvest in over in the Kimberley, have the capacity to harvest sort of 6 to 10 tonnes in their own communities every season. And we think there's this alliance probably represents about 70% of the national harvest. And yeah, we think over the next 5 to 10 years, the alliance will be able to deliver large tonnage of Kakadu plum into national markets.
And because of that geographic spread between Meningita and Dampier Peninsula in the Kimberley, the harvest period for this alliance would be quite long, would it?
Yeah, it is. It starts sort of around Christmas time, a bit after Christmas over in the Kimberley. And then the season really slowly moves east over towards Arnhem Land. And so you're looking at a harvest season that sort of lasts from Christmas time, hits the Tumara region around a bit after Easter, and then really peters out in Arnhem Land towards sort of May and June.
Is there room for this alliance to grow?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the upcoming season is going to be critical. It's going to be the first harvest season where the alliance has been formed. 9 members at this stage are probably enough for the harvest season, but I think there is a really strong will from all of those members to make this alliance open to any Aboriginal harvesting and processing businesses into the future. It's a great initiative, and it's an initiative that really gives that security of supply to buyers. The more the merrier.
If an Indigenous community wanted to start up a commercial plantation, how would the alliance approach that?
I think, well, there are members in the alliance, such as Mama Balungin Aboriginal Corporation and Lombardina out in the Kimberley, both of whom who have some small-scale plantations in and have aspirations to develop large-scale plantations. So, you know, I think that is part of the strategy going forward, and I think if we are going to supply over 100 tonnes a year into the market, then plantations are an inevitability. But I think on the flip side, we're still very much a long way away from really understanding how Kakadu plum can be grown in a plantation situation, really for the next decade and probably more. Wild harvest is going to be absolutely sort of the bedrock of how Kakadu plum is delivered into markets.
Jacob Habnes from the Indigenous Land Corporation talking about that new alliance. It's got 9 members spread across Northern Australia, the Northern Australia Aboriginal Kakadu Plum Alliance, trying to get that consistency in supply for that native fruit to the many markets that would like to get their hands on it. ABC WA, it is 13 to 1. Earlier in the hour, talking about the animal rights group PETA, the new video that's on their homepage if you want to have a look at it for yourself. The video really looking at sheep producers not using pain relief and some of the behaviour that goes on in some places with some shearers are slapping and punching. That's what can be seen in the video. And Peter's saying that the video was recorded legally and has been handed over to the authorities. But Joe Hall, who's the CEO of the grower group Wool Producers Australia, has defended the industry. She says 80% of wool producers are using pain relief, and the video isn't an accurate reflection of industry practices.
Look, the reality is that, you know, even standard animal husbandry practices, when taken out of context, can appear somewhat unappealing or even brutal, particularly when they're coupled with uneducated and emotive commentary.
So was there anything in the video, apart from, say, the violent handling of some sheep, that alarmed or concerned you? Because those practices around castration and mulesing are pretty standard in the industry, aren't they? That it's a fairly accurate reflection of what goes on if you take the commentary out.
Look, I have only had the chance to view that footage once. I am in transit at the moment, but I don't feel comfortable commenting or providing a deep analysis on the footage there, but yes, as you said, the castration and tail docking, appeared fairly standard.
So what do you think of PETA's renewed campaign? I mean, the last time they did this, there were 4 shearers that ended up being fined and banned from handling sheep.
So Wool Producers Australia absolutely condemns any type of animal cruelty, and those that are found guilty of these offences have no place in our industry. Those cases that you referred to went through the judicial process and they were found guilty and handed their sentences, and we support that. As I said, anybody found guilty deserves to have the full force of the law thrown at them when it comes to animal cruelty.
And do you think the industry has done enough to respond to the campaign that Peter's run now over a number of years?
The reality is this group isn't going to go away. This group isn't concerned with animal welfare. Let's face it, they want to shut down animal production industries full stop. They also, further to that, have no time for even companion animals. So I guess as an industry, we're not overly concerned about what this group thinks.
It's not affecting the industry in terms of markets. It's not affecting the industry's social license to operate in any way.
Look, when there's footage like this, it doesn't help our industry, I'm sure, but AWI have invested significant funds working with the supply chain to educate them about breach strike management. I think their own figures are $30 million since 2005 on breach strike prevention. So, again, it's an ongoing process of education to the supply chain.
Peter would probably argue that not enough has been done to move the industry away from mulesing, or not enough has been done to provide pain relief in the meantime. What's your view of that?
Look, wool producers' policy is that if you mules, you must apply pain relief. We're not a regulatory body. We cannot mandate pain relief, but we certainly say that given the availability of pain relief for mulesing now and other procedures, that they must be used.
That would seem to be the main message of the campaign this time around, that no pain relief was being used in these circumstances. How often is pain relief used now? How widespread is pain relief in the industry, and how can you be certain about those figures?
Well, there's varying figures available to industry, regarding industry about pain relief usage. I think there's suggestions of up to 80% voluntary uptake, which is great. The NWD doesn't show that high of usage. That's the National Wool Declaration. It's still voluntary, and it is the usage has been increasing, which is encouraging.
So you think about 80% of the industry is using pain relief routinely?
According to AWI, that's the figure.
As we heard from Tony York from WA Farmers earlier in the hour, he said that figure is a lot lower here in Western Australia compared to other states as far as the pain relief usage here in WA. That was Jo Hall. She's from Wool Producers, talking to David Claughton. Laura Wayman-Jones is from PETA and is still calling on consumers to boycott wool products. She says Australia is lagging behind the rest of the world in addressing serious animal welfare concerns.
The Eyewitness found workers struck sheep in the face with sharp metal clippers and in the stomach over and over again with a bent knee, showing once again that wool is a product of extreme suffering for sheep. The evidence was gathered in Victoria and New South Wales during 2018. Obviously, we're hoping for cruelty to animal charges to be laid against the shearers who were striking and putting their knees on the sheep. But also, this is a conversation we need to be having with consumers who are buying wool without realising the suffering it causes these animals.
The industry is saying that 80% of wool growers are using pain relief. You didn't show anybody using pain relief in this particular video. Do you think that's an accurate figure, an accurate indication of where the industry is at?
It's very difficult to know how many farmers are using pain relief with mulesing. And I don't certainly think the figures are anywhere near 80%.
Well, they have to make a statement on the National Vendor Declaration form. And you've only shown two operations here. So it's certainly a possibility that there is some evidence to support that claim.
Sure, but even if they are using pain relief, anyone who watches this footage will clearly see these animals are frightened and they're crying out in agony. It's certainly not a peaceful procedure by any means for these animals, regardless of whether or not a bit of pain relief is used, which is clearly not used in a particular instance. But I think realistically, we should be having conversations not just about relieving their pain, but getting rid of this cruel practice altogether.
Well, the industry says it's spent $30 million so far to find a way to manage the fly strike problem, which is why sheep are mulesed in the first place. Isn't that a significant step in the right direction for the industry?
It's obviously, we would like to see more to be done for sheep to phase this out. But pardon the pun, but Australia really has become the black sheep when it comes to mulesing. It's been phased out in New Zealand. They've, in fact, just recently passed a law banning the practice. South America doesn't do it anymore. South Africa no longer muleses. Farmers there are managing not to mule their sheep, so it's obviously possible to avoid both mulesing and fly strike. And realistically, if Australia's wool industry can't exist without cruelly mutilating the backsides of sheep, then it really shouldn't be existing at all.
Is that your end point? Is that you prefer that the sheep industry or the wool industry didn't exist?
Anytime animals are used for profit, their welfare suffers. And obviously, this is not just an issue of mulesing. There's also, as we see in the video captured in New South Wales, shearers are continuing to abuse sheep as they're being sheared. They're punching them with metal clippers. They're standing on them. And this is not the first time we've seen that. As you mentioned, shearers were charged last year with cruelty to animals and banned and fined.
So agriculture is clearly dependent on making a profit. So that is your position, isn't it? No agriculture, effectively.
No animal agriculture. I think with all social progress, industry must respond to change, and Australian farmers need to adapt their businesses in order to better serve consumers who don't want to pay for cruelty to animals, and they don't want to pay for animals to suffer for their clothes. There is a range of materials used which are essentially becoming vegan wool, and if the Australian market can begin to tap into that, then there's a way forward.
Laura Wayman-Jones from Peter with the ABC's David Claughton. Peter says the material on that video that's on its website was gathered legally by an employee and it's been handed over to authorities in New South Wales and Victoria. 4 minutes to one on the Country Hour. Off to the markets now, and only 9,000 sheep and lambs penned at Mouchet this morning. That's down 2,000 on last week. John Testro is at Mouchet for you right now. John, I hear prices went up. Do they go up by much?
Yeah, good afternoon, Belinda. It was a very good time for vendors today. Either the market was very firm or $3 to $7 dearer across the board and with no negative results. In fact, the best trade lambs today averaged $6.84, and that's only 10 cents below the Eastern market indicator. That's a lot better than the $2 it was back in early October. So a great day for everyone today. I'll just get into it. In the lamb section, graziers paid $45 to $69 for the very light crossbred stores. They remain firm. Air freight types to the trade at $71 to $114 were firm. Trade lambs, this is where the job got better. $125 to $157, they were $3 to $5 dearer. The heavies at $155 to $168, they gained $7. Ram lambs were from $105 to $144, and they were up by $5. The best hoggets sold at $96 to $121 to the trade. They were up by $4. Very light store merino young ewes to restockers sold at $40 to $70. They remained firm, but the very light weight young wethers to graziers sold from $45 to $96, with the mediums at $109, all up by $7. The mutton market continued to be strong. Processors paid for bony ewes from $60 to $102. Trade ewes at $100 to $128, all firm, with a heavy ewe mutton from $105 to $140, up by $4. The restockers on the better lines of ewe mutton today, they paid $85 to $104 for the medium weights and $124 to $140 for the heavies, and they were up by $7 on similar types last week. Prime wethers today sold from $97 to $121, firm to processors, with the better rams at mainly $68 to $86, all firm. This has been John Testro for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the ABC. At Mouchet. Thanks, Belinda.
Thank you for the wrap, John. Appreciate that. And tomorrow, off to Katanning. So we'll see how the sheep and lambs are selling at the Katanning sale yard tomorrow. That's with Tracy Kilner. It's a minute and a half to one.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, police in Melbourne arrest three men for allegedly plotting an attack in a public place. Politicians campaigning in this weekend's Victorian election promise they'll cut consumers' power bills. So which party offers the more palatable solution? And what do students really think about school? And why don't we use their views to help improve Australia's education system?
We need to spend much more time listening to students talk about their experience of education. We don't make decisions for other groups of people in our society without hearing from them first, and young people are no exception, and certainly students are no exception either.
More than the headlines, the world today.
So the news is next at 1 o'clock, followed by the world today. Your comments still coming through on the latest PETA video, which is up on its website, really targeting some of the practices, and you can see some of that footage yourself in the video, and also really honing in on pain relief or the lack of pain relief for mulesing. This through on the text. God, let's ban farmers from farming. Everyone start growing rice. We'll just live on that here on out. Thanks for your comments today. On ABC WA, it is time for the news. It's 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.